Welcome to Nowhere to Run with Christopher White.
Chris in Tennessee, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey everyone, welcome to Nowhere to Run. My name is Chris. Thank you for tuning in to the show, however you found it. I am really glad that you did. There are a lot of ways to get to the website. You can go to nowheretorunradio.com, and that'll get you there. Also, you can go to conspiracyclothes.com/nowheretorun, or just conspiracyclothes.com now. I just changed that over and took the old conspiracyclothes.com site down and just replaced it with the nowheretorunradio.com front page. So, a lot of roads leading to the same site now. You can find links to email me through that site. Okay, so let's just jump right in here. What I want to talk about is what can we do, essentially? What is it that we can do about all the stuff we have learned about a great deal of things? And what should our focus be about what can we do? Obviously, it's to the main primary thing, as far as I see it, is to warn people. You know, I was hit with this idea today riding my bike in my small town, and you know, looking at these people and thinking, these are the people that I should concern myself with. You know, I mean, there is every place in the world for the internet, and those people my burden, as it were, for a lot of the truth seekers and whatever they want to be called or whatever we want to be called. But there's also, all of us have our own hometown. You know, there could be big cities, small towns, whatever. But we could have definitely a big impact. One person can do a lot of serious good in their own cities. And I want to show you a few ways how to do that, or at least how I think it can be done. Where to start? I think that what hit me today the most was, I guess, the past few weeks I've been concerned about what can I do. I wanted to devote myself more totally to the Great Commission. That is, I guess, evangelizing is the only word I have for it. And I was kind of lamenting that I don't yet have it in me, the fire to just be out there, Russ Dizdar style, and just talking to every person I see, you know, every person that crosses my path. But I know that's a matter of fire that I can attain, and once I'm there, I won't be able to stop it, and that's all good. But right now, I just don't have it where I can be like, hey, you want to talk about Jesus, you know, even though I'd have a lot to say. And I don't know, I keep thinking, well, that's just not me, I'm just not that person, maybe I got some other kind of thing, but that's not it. But then I thought about it, and it was like, the thing that everybody has in common that actually does that, it's knocking on doors or, you know, whatever they're doing, they have something in their hands that they're constantly giving somebody that really explains everything. And this goes for, by the way, this goes for Christians and non-Christians alike. If your thing is, it doesn't matter if it's vaccines or fluoride or aspartame or whatever it is, 9/11, whatever your thing is, this will apply to you too. So you don't have to stop listening necessarily. You can if you want, because it is going to be rather Christian-y pretty soon. So they, and depending on how good that thing is that they hand the person, it really makes all the difference. It really doesn't even matter what you say, because most people are going to reject anything that you say right then anyway. So it doesn't matter if you have, I mean, different individuals, depending on the situation, it will be necessary to talk about, hey, what is this? You know, tell me what it is. It's kind of thing. I don't know. That would be an opportunity, you know, if what you're giving them you know about and feel strongly about. And that's what it all comes down to. If we're talking about, and you know, just a piece of paper that explains stuff, I've explained in the past that I think what we should really have is a series of tracks, like spelled like land tracks, you know, like Christian tracks, but good ones, you know, really, really good ones. And things that work and explain a lot of this stuff, you know, for I would really like an A to Z kind of thing. Like, I'm going to start here and take you here and reference everything that's going on and just blow their minds in, like, small print, you know, back-to-back 8.5 by 11 sheets of paper. And I did write something like that, and I'll tell you about that in here in a second. But it doesn't have to be that. It doesn't have to be, let's just throw the kitchen sink at somebody. It can be a very simple situation, too. And I think that that's the crucial thing here, is no matter what you're doing, whatever your burden for is, it should be the very best possible thing, especially considering the resources that are available to us. Okay, what I'm going to do as far as Christian tracks, I'm going to put in the show notes section of this show, which will be probably October 3rd, 2008. I'm going to put just a massive list of websites that have PDFs available of Christian tracks. And I've kind of looked through a lot of them, and you know, I kind of agree with, for the most part, a lot of those tracks. I mean, there's no possible way that I could have looked at all of them. Some of them I don't really agree with that much, but whatever. There's so many of them that I'm expecting anybody that really has this burden to go check them out, you know. And what I would really like to see is out of that group somebody being like, or if you know of one that you've used or whatever, please email it to me. I want like the best of the best of the best, the almost the best track bar none. It needs to be the best thing ever. And if we have to make one, then that's what we need to do. And that needs to be the same thing. There are no tracks out there for, like, taking somebody about, hey, the New World Order is this, 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 and this, and this, and it encompasses this, this, and this, and this, and it can be fought with Jesus. And that's, you know, I mean, there's so many different angles to take with all this stuff. And the same thing with, you know, okay, but with fluoride or vaccines or 9/11 or what have you. But it, I think in tandem, it should work with a written thing. You should have a DVD. And I think the DVD thing is just absolutely crucial. If you have a DVD burner, that's great. If you don't, you need to get one, because it's crucial to how one person can literally change their city, town, state, country. And I'll give you a few examples of how to do that. But first, if you have a DVD burner, you should learn how to use it. It does take about a day or two to figure out how to really work with the files, especially if you're getting files off the internet and using them in that way. But it's also about pairing things up. Like, for example, one idea I thought, okay, I did start writing today what I was talking about, just a front-back, highly referenced thing about what's going on. And as I was writing, I was like, I've written this before. And it kind of is settled with the... And the vast satanic conspiracy article that I wrote, and so I went back today and just redid the whole thing and edited it down and took out a lot of stuff that wasn't quite, you know, right. And when I wrote it, I wasn't quite as sure about a lot of this stuff, and so I had a little few mistakes and things like that. So fixed it and, you know, made the checked the references and everything. And so I reposted that, but I think that I can fit that on one page front and one page back. And I thought maybe I would burn the interview that I did with Russ Dizdar on a sheet or on a DVD and then hand that out. I mean, here is the vast satanic conspiracy completely referenced, and then the Russ Dizdar interview movie. And I thought, I mean, I don't know who I would hand it to, especially, you know, in a small town. It's like, hey, you're that guy that hands out the wacky, wacky stuff. But, I mean, I could definitely hand it out to, you know, I could put it in the boxes of the newspaper or, you know, whatever. I could put it on the front door of the Capitol. And I could just think of all kinds of creative places to put that thing, or hand it to individuals, certainly. You know, I think that in this kind of situation, if you're working for the Lord, he's going to be leading you to places, and especially if you have multi different things. Like another option would be, there is that movie online about house church, and you could have that house church DVD and have like a write up, a real quick, you know, five things why house church. You know, you can go to those house church ministries and just have a real quick thing, you know, leave them on the doors of people that are going into church, you know, or on their car windows or something. You know, just have the Lord lead you to which car to put it on. I mean, you're just the messenger. He's got all that covered up, you know. And certainly the biggest thing here is just straight evangelism. That is, if you can find a track that just really says it, you know, that really actually makes a great case, and then you put that with a DVD of like, well, I just burnt one now, and I'm not recommending this. I'm actually hoping that somebody can tell me something better. But what I put on there was just a few of the movies that I made, the evidences for the existence of Jesus, and the C.S. Lewis, Lord Liar, Lunatic, and I think that I put some other stuff on there. And, I mean, that's good and everything, but I think that I could do better by putting clips, like YouTube clips of, like, Ravi Zacharias and maybe William Lane Craig and, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe the evidence for the existence of Jesus or whatever. But, you know, whatever it is, whatever you found on YouTube, the very best things. I mean, it should be nothing but the best, you know? If you're putting the best into the material, then you all of a sudden will be the kind of person that will walk up to somebody and give it to them because you've got the fire, you know? And you don't have to say anything, but you probably will. And that's because you've got the fire. Now, of course, if your burden is for 9/11 vaccines, whatever, that is extremely important because, you know, they're going to be, your city and town is eventually going to be faced with a judgment that, oh, we're going to have to mandatory vaccines. Or maybe if you had a burden for your police department to know that they didn't have to acquiesce to the federal government, that it's the sheriff's right to turn that down. They're probably long gone, but, you know, as far as, you know, already accepting much federal support and whatever and are very indebted to the system or whatever, but maybe not. You know, there's those articles out there, you know, of sheriffs, you know, not letting the federal whatever do things in their thing or, you know, exercising their jurisdiction. If that's your burden, you know, send them DVDs. Get to them, you know, talk to them, whatever. Burn specific DVDs with specific information and give it to them. When I did the thing with fluoride a while back, was basically, you know, I went to fluorideaction.com. Fluorideaction.com is, I think, the best way to get it. It's the FAN network, F-A-N, Fluoride Action Network. But you got to be careful because the ADA bought one of the .coms or .orgs, I can't remember, and they like did a pro fluoride thing. But anyway, so I you know, made a packet full of all the you know, peer reviewed data and, you know, some really appropriate information in the letter that our state senator sent to all the water districts and all this, you know, very relevant, very in your face material in these press packets, and also put the Fluoride Deception Christopher Bryson DVD in there. And that's and I sent it to everybody in the city council, you know, got that. I sent it to, I sent emails of basically the same information to every school teacher, every kind of people like that. And I think the school teachers, if you can find a list of every school teacher in your city, county, whatever, and send them all something because they, and the PTA or whatever, because those people are, you know, you're not going to eventually probably change the city council. They are way probably in bed to whoever, whatever. But you can fire up the city. And you can do that by the trickle-down people like your school teachers, like people like that. If, you know, a lot of these people are, you know, just like you and whatever, they're certainly not co-opted or whatever the word would be. So, so I don't know. So whatever your burden is, you can do it. And I think that there are plenty of movies out online. You can go to my website, which is newertorunradio.com, and in the links section, you will find not only the Vest Satanic Conspiracy article, but also a list of a lot of movies that I recommend and things like that. And those are good movies to download if you know how to download stuff from Google or YouTube and turn them into DVDs. It's kind of a process. Another idea that I thought of, which would be a good combo packet, would be like taking the movie, the intelligent design movie called, I can't remember. It's really, really good. I think it's also listed in my link section, but I'll go to that right now. But you can accompany that with the Darwin's Deal Breakers article that I wrote, which is probably horribly punctuated and awful. I haven't looked at that one. If it's anything like the Vast Satanic Conspiracy one, it probably is, which I'm a very bad writer in that regard. Okay, it's called Unlocking the Mysteries of Life. You could put that intelligent design movie, which is an incredibly well done movie about intelligent design, accompanied with some information about intelligent design or whatever. The article that I did, Darwin's Deal Breakers, is basically taking a lot of really a synopsis of the movie, and so it's an interesting combination there. So you can make up combinations, good written material with good DVDs, and you can change the world. I mean, you can, and I, as I said, it really does come down to the quality of the thing that you are trying to hand out. And I do need your help on this too. You can go to the show notes section of this show, and you can look at all the links to the just various tracks online. If you find one in there that's just awesome, you know, please send me the link to it. And I think that also a website should be made, maybe by us, maybe through Revelations Radio Network or something, that we could make a website with just putting these tracks and maybe these combo deals and PDFs and different things like that for the different things. But if you can write a track and you know about some of the stuff that we talk about and you have a particular burden and you know exactly what that burden is and you're like, oh, yeah, he's talking to me about that thing. Yeah, I could probably do that. Do it. Do it and send me a link. One way or another, I think that we need to get a website done with this kind of thing going, because it's a resource that, that we can keep turning back to and get people to save their town. And if there's any way that's going to happen, it's going to happen through prayer. It's just fervent, absolute, on your knees, praying, like deciding, I'm going to change the city, I'm going to change the town, I'm going to change the county, whatever. Just start praying against stuff, for people, for the leaders, against spirits and deception, all in the name of Jesus Christ, and just pleading with him, repenting for the city, just getting after it. You know, he is, it's a real biblical thing to have people, you know, praying for the city and having God literally change things, move mountains in a place, and, you know, encompass that with, you know, following his directions and whatever it is that you do like this. You can certainly change the city just by evangelism itself. So, you know, make it a important part of your prayer life to really get after it. Put it on, you know, your prayer list right at the top. You know, pray for your city. Pray for everything about it. Pray against evil for it. Get people to join in. Have group prayers. Do you mind if we pray about the city? I mean, just meet up with people just to do that. And you can really move mountains. I'm convinced about it. Okay, I'm... think that I said all I wanted to say on that, so I'll take a break and take a breath, and I'll see you on the other side of that.
Hi, my name is Doug. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, son of a preacher and missionaries. I always knew God was real. When I was growing up in rural southern Mexico, it was a common thing for me to hear stories from other missionaries about things God had done. Nonetheless, I was entrenched in the Southern Baptist machine for many years. But I began to see that they were leaving things out. They denied that the gifts of the Spirit were real and for today. Some even deny that God heals people anymore. But I read about the church in China and heard firsthand accounts from people I trust of seeing amazing miracles in India and Africa and Indonesia. Some have even seen limbs regrow before their eyes. A friend of mine personally interviewed a man named Daniel Ekechukwu, who was raised from the dead after more than 2 days. He even interviewed the doctors and undertaker that had begun embalming the body. There are medical certificates to verify the death. Google it and see. I have undergraduate degrees in psychology and religion. I have a master's degree in education administration. I've worked in administration at the college level and worked in Washington, D.C. area as the vice president of marketing for a national franchise. I've opened my own businesses. In 2005, my furniture company was listed as the number 4 fastest growing company in Kansas City. We were named one of the top 25 small businesses in the region. We grew 4,000% in 5 years. I was teaching Sunday school, member of a Baptist church, but I was still missing something. Anyway, I had heard God speak before. I knew that he'd told me to marry my wife, he'd helped with the business, but I had never seen anything like the power that I heard about in China and other places. I begged and pleaded for him to show himself to me in a bigger, stronger, more powerful way. In fact, I prayed sincerely that I didn't care what it cost, my business, my life, my family, comforts, prison, torture, whatever. I just wanted to be dangerous to the enemy and make a difference in this war between good and evil. I wanted all of the Jesus that was available. I prayed for wisdom. I prayed to see things through his eyes. On November 23rd, 2004, he answered that prayer and wrecked me forever. He showed me a vision of how he feels about this mess we've made of his planet and his church. From that night on, my life turned upside down. He scrubbed lust out of me. No more video games. No more Fox News and Rush Limbaugh and other junk. No more hobbies or distractions. Just an absolute urgency and a single-mindedness to turn this thing around. And I started weeping and groaning and mourning in prayer all the time. And then he started to talk to me more. a lot more and a lot louder. A week later, a family of missionaries shows up from Canada because God told him to go to Liberty, Missouri and volunteer at my furniture store. Then more people started showing up, and God started completely reworking our business plan according to his purposes. Then we took some of the space in our building and started a food pantry and a clothes closet and took used furniture to meet needs in the community. We were having prayer meetings all the time in the furniture store. People started to come to get help, and we'd pray for them and stuff would happen. People were getting instantly delivered of addictions and depression and agoraphobia and even schizophrenia. I saw chronic pain leave people instantly and stay gone. I've seen people healed of autism and lupus and Alzheimer's and fibromyalgia and others. I've seen people's leukemia go into remission. I've seen epilepsy go away permanently. I've seen bones healed instantly. I've seen ears open. I've seen more than I can remember. But the best miracles are the spiritual healings, not the physical healings. A lady that used to be into all kinds of dark things before God redeemed her and delivered her came to the furniture store. She knows the demons are real because she's seen them and talked to them and been trapped by them for years. Now she's so sensitive that she can see them on people. She can tell you all about a stranger in the mall. And I've seen it be deadly accurate and get people free. And I thought, cool, I want that. If there's a war between good and evil, I don't want to be blasting away in the dark. I want to see the bad guys and pick them off with one shot. The Lord says that if you don't have, it's because you don't ask. So I started to ask for the gift of discernment of spirits as mentioned in 1 Corinthians 12. And God started to answer. As I learned and practiced and was tested and refined, he dialed me up more and more so I could see them better. Sometimes the Lord tells me other things about the person that only God would know, to help them have faith and to show them that he's watching everything and they're not going to be able to hide it. And the proof of that is that over and over I've been able to tell strangers stuff that speaks right to their heart. They burst into tears and repent and get right with God. Or we rip the demons off of them and then they're clear-headed and free of addiction or pain or stress or fear or whatever it was. I see radical personal transformations. I'm leaving a lot of stuff out, like the time Satanists ritually sacrificed a cat in front of my furniture store during one of our prayer meetings, like the people coming from all over the world to volunteer for a for-profit business, lots of institutional church leaders that really, really didn't like me saying things about the problems with the status quo, daily miracles, amazing stories of persecution and provision and protection and healing and deliverance, and constant and radical and personal a painful refining as God killed big giant chunks of me and kept asking me if I was willing to lay down even more. In the summer of 2006, God said to walk away from my multi-million-dollar business and serve him full-time. Okay, Lord, what do you want me to do with the business? Walk away. Let them throw the whole thing in the dumpster and don't look back. So I did, because he's God and his ways are not our ways, and I was sure it was him. In October of 2006, God sent me out. I had about $100 to my name and my van. I had no idea where I was going or why, but he said, go. What followed was 5 months of driving 18,000 miles to 32 states entirely directed by the voice of God. Every stop, every intersection, every meal. He provided for every need. Strangers would give me money. Always the right amount at just the right moment. Amazing divine appointments. More than I can count. When the van broke down, he replaced it in an amazing way. I never asked anybody for anything. I was working for God, and he was paying me in all kinds of unusual, unexpected, beautiful ways. It was a constant adventure, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. There was pain and crying and persecution and healing and victory and daily miracles, but mostly I would walk with my hand in the hand of God all the time. I hear his voice, and I obey. Nobody can talk me out of the undeniable fact that he's real. He's personal, and he cares about me. He knows every detail, and I want him to direct all of my paths. I wear what he tells me to wear. I say what he tells me to say. I go where he tells me to go. I wait on him to pay all my bills, and he's always faithful. I eat what he tells me to eat. 2 years ago, he started asking me to fast. At first, it was without food. Then it was without food or water. They got longer and more frequent. He dropped 75 pounds off of me. How do I know it's God? Because if I decide to fast, I feel rotten and I get dizzy and shaky. But if God tells me to fast, I feel fine. For the last 2 years, I averaged 3 or 4 days a week without food or water. Sometimes one day or a part of a day, sometimes in stretches of 6, 7, or 8 days at a time. I don't care what anybody says. If I go 8 days without food or water, feeling fine, keeping my regular schedule and activities, that's a miracle from God. I have lots of witnesses that know this to be true. I had sleep apnea and was sleeping with a breathing machine. Fairly early on, he told me that he put the breath of life in me and he would keep it in me. I was to pray every night and put him in charge and stop using the machine. I can tell you, it was an addiction. I felt horrible without it, and the sleep study said I woke myself up 600 times a night and my blood oxygen dropped to 70%. But since the day the Lord told me to stop, I've never used it again and I feel great. I'm not saying any of this to glorify me. I'm not unique in this. I have all kinds of folks around here and that I've met elsewhere that hear God real good all the time, conversationally, all day long. He's my dad. He has stuff to say. If I will shut up and listen, the sheep are supposed to know the shepherd's voice. How do I know it's him? Because over and over, I give somebody the exact amount of money that they need for the bill that they were praying about. Or I call at the exact moment and say the right thing. Or I walk into a pastor's office, quote him the scriptures he read before I got there, tell him about the sin in his life, and ask him if he wants to repent now. Then he cries and we pray together. Over and over and over. I couldn't begin to tell all the stories, undeniable stories. So there are folks that will listen to this and think I'm nuts. Most of my family thinks I'm nuts. Fine, think what you want. A whole bunch of pastors I know think I'm nuts. But it's just because I insist that the Bible is real, it's for today, it means what it says, and everything of it in there is available to us right now. And since there's a long string of people that have been healed and delivered and are hearing God and walking in holiness because of my absolute conviction on this point, I can't really see how you're going to change my mind. Jesus didn't give you any middle ground. You cannot assert that he was a nice guy. He was either the Son of God or a raving megalomaniacal loony. He cannot be a wise prophet that died like so many others. Either he's the Son of God or he's completely nuts. And he said we should be like him, so I'm not leaving you any middle ground either. I am either hearing God and I'm right, or I'm completely nuts. I don't want you to think I'm a nice guy. I'm either a danger to society or I'm onto something. I don't care which way you decide because I cannot be talked down. I've seen too much. I know God is real. I hear his voice and I see him work through me and the others around me every day. Your theoretical arguments cannot trump my personal experience. I'm not like the lukewarm, pew-sitting Christians you might have talked to before. I mean it all the way, because I prayed for fear of the Lord, and he gave me lots of it. And I'm more in awe of his majesty and glory and love and tenderness and wrath and mercy than I am worried about what you think of me. But I love you. Thanks for listening. www.fellowshipofthemartyrs.com.
Russ Dizdar explains his ministry, Shatter the Darkness.
Almost 20 years now, we've been just kind of just trying to help people, minister to people, share with people coming out of cults, you know, just mind control, the occult, left-hand path stuff. And then we ran into the real underground that's been going on for a long time. And so it has a lot to do with deliverance and dealing with the dark side and power encounters and, you know, as confronting perpetrators of violence on children and ritual abuse. It deals with healing the hearts of the victims and, you know, keeping our guard and trying to do what we can to expose it, stop some of it.
You can visit Russ Dizdar's website at shatterthedarkness.net, where you'll find hours of free MP3s and podcasts, as well as courses for your church or your ministry to begin to learn how to deal with encounters of this nature in a biblical way. shatterthedarkness.net.
Real quick, I wanted to add to that last commercial. I saw on Russ's website today that he's offering the course, The Black Awakening, which is a 24-plus-hour audio course on his website for any size donation. We'll get you that entire course and the booklet and everything, the notes anyway, that come with it. So go over to shatterthedarkness.net, and you can pick up the course, The Black Awakening. He's got a lot of really, really good courses over there, freedom encounters and things like that are really, really good courses. But the Black Awakening course is for any size donation, so check that out, shatterthedarkness.net. All right, that was a clip from Doug from fellowshipofthemartyrs.com, as he mentioned, and you can go to their YouTube site. They have a pretty unique YouTube ministry as well, which you can go to, let's see, it's youtube.com/FOTM1, that stands for Fellowship of the Martyrs, one, the number one. So you can also get them from my YouTube site, which is youtube.com/nowheretorun1984. But yeah, I like them. I've been listening to some of their audiobooks that they have for free on their website and stuff like that, and it just seems like a good thing to me. I actually emailed them about Russ Dizdar because I know that they're getting some deliverance issues showing up, and I just, in case they were getting a lot of multiple personality disorder / you know, satanic ritual abuse, I sent them some Russ Dizdar info, so I hope that helps. But I also thought it was cool. They deal with their detractors and naysayers and things like that in a really good, loving way, which is just so much more than I could say for myself. They really, you know, on the individual things, you know, that people would say about them or, you know, accuse them of, they really dealt with each one in a really, you know, meticulous way. There's like a whole section of their site devoted to that kind of thing. I mean, I just, if I did that, I would also have an entire section of my site devoted to it too, but I thought it was pretty cool. One person said they, you know, were a cult because they were hearing God talk to them and things like that, and it was great. They had like a cult expert come in and give them a clean bill of health, and it was just cool. But I'd just like to say in general, that's a really important thing to do, especially with this kind of thing. I'm thinking probably right now more like intelligent design and scientific stuff like that. There's always going to be a equal and opposite detractor of somebody that is just devoted to, all on somebody's case, whoever it is, a scientist or whatever, especially that kind of detail. Okay, I think what I'm going to do here with the remainder of the time is play a clip from an interview with a lady named Svali, S-V-A-L-I, I think. And if you type Svali into a search engine, you'll be met with an article she had written, and they're posted on Mind Control Forums. And Mind Control Forums is a great website. I encourage you to check it out. There's a lot of really, really good information on that website about a lot of related issues. So if you look through that, now she was a former, what you would call, I don't know, Illuminati, I guess, you know, whistleblower. And there's not a whole lot of real ones out there, I don't think. But she, in my opinion, is definitely one of those people. She was a former trainer and handler trainer. So she knows a good deal about programming, how to program, stuff like that. And so the articles that she wrote that are available in the Mind Control forums are just a lot of information about protocols and things like that and equipment used and how they do it and why they do it as far as programming people. So maybe that would be good for a lot of you out there maybe looking for this kind of information. So, and one thing I found amazing while looking through that information that she had written on Mind Control forums was how much effort and how many protocols were written specifically about keeping these people away from true Christian doctrine. I mean, they have entire programs written to create sometimes called revulsion therapy and different things like that, where they will get sick and things if they open up a Bible or have scripture quoted to them. There's a lot of really weird stuff like that that I think should, you know, build your faith that the enemy who are running this system are dreadfully scared of something as simple as, you know, the Bible. But I did call Russ Dizdar's show and ask him about it, and he said that, you know, it checked out and he knew about her and stuff, and he actually had talked to somebody that he knew. I don't know if they were a multiple. I think that he said that they were a multiple as well and had known about her too and had the report that she had actually been killed. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that the interview I'm going to play is pretty, I think it's the only interview that she did. I know that she'd done some other stuff, but like, you know, writings and stuff like that, but I don't know that, I think this is the only interview she did, and she talks a little bit about that on the show with Greg Szymanski is who did the thing. I'm not exactly the biggest Greg Szymanski fan in the world, but, you know, and you got to kind of read through the lines a little bit with that too, because whatever. So I'm going to play this, and I think it's really important. And if you have any questions about it or whatever, you can email me at chris@conspiracyclose.com. Don't forget about the first part of the show with the tracks and everything like that. Just really helped me do this. I think that we can really change, you know, the world with this. So if you think that whatever your thing is, please help. If it's going through those tracks and picking out the best ones, if it's writing your own, if it's helping in some way, let's just help with that in any way possible. If somebody knows a great movie to use in that effort, please email me, chris@conspiracyclose.com. Thanks, and here is Svali and Greg Szymanski.
You're listening to the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. 2 hours. 2 hours with great interviews all the time. We get into the news behind the scenes that the mainstream media refuses to cover. What a shame. Let me just update some things before I tell you who my guest is today. I've been promoting it all week, and we're going to get deep inside the family, the order, the Illuminati, today for 2 hours. And you got to stay with us from the beginning to the end of this interview. Okay, we're back. It's 8 minutes after the hour, and we're going to get deep inside the Illuminati, the family, the order. We have a guest that was involved with this group, born into it for over 30 years, and her name is Svali. Svali, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Well, it's nice to have you here, and I know you don't give radio interviews, and I really want to thank you because I think it really does help the American people understand about this secret organization that you were born into. So I guess before we, I guess we can just start from the beginning and tell us right from the beginning you were born into this from wealthy parents, and tell us about your training in this group and when you were a young child and then up into your orientation at the Vatican. Go ahead.
That's a pretty broad area, though, Greg. I mean, that could take hours, if you know what I mean.
Could just outline it for us.
Yeah. I mean, I was born in the group. I was born in Germany, came to the U.S. very young, and basically went through all the training that the group, all members of the group do undergo training to different degrees, depending on the role. By the time I was a teenager, I was a youth leader, and by the time I was 22, I became the youngest member of Leadership Council in San Diego County. And at that time, I was a head trainer. I was the sixth trainer. I eventually moved up to the second position. Mm-hmm. And when I was 12, I had mentioned with you the ceremony at the Vatican. That they really do make all leadership in the group undergo at some point.
Now, basically when you were growing up, I remember you told me that you were instilled at a young age, you were born to a very wealthy, well-to-do family, you moved back to the States. You were told at a very young age you were special, you were chosen, correct?
Well, they tell everyone in the group that they're special and chosen. And, in fact, that's one of the things that made me very cynical when I was older is that, you will never meet a person who's an Illuminati who's not been told and programmed for years that they're special. They're the only one that can do things for, quote-unquote, family. But I was told, yes, I would do great things for family one day. And the reason why, I guess, I can filter some of this with objective view is I know what my role in the group was, and it was over quite a significant number of other people. So I don't evaluate my role or specialness within the group not so much by what I was told, but by what I did.
So you reach the age of 12, and then you're told by your parents you're going to an induction ceremony in the Vatican. Can you tell us how that happened and what occurred at that ceremony when you went there?
Okay. This isn't easy to talk about, as you know. When I was 12, I was flown over to Germany, and I was at what I'll call them the German father's house over there. And there was some preparation for a few days beforehand, and I was told that there would be a very important ceremony, and it was considered a sealing ceremony at that point. And basically, I was told a little bit about what I was expected to do during the ceremony. When we got there, we went to the Vatican. Underneath the Vatican, there's a large room that I described to you when we talked before. It has 13 catacomb chambers leading into it and what they do is they, as you go down these steps into the room, you can see that it's almost circular, and so they're all around it, and they bring out the mummies from the catacombs, and they set them beside each one, and they say that the spirits of the fathers watching over the ceremony. And during the ceremony, there was a large table in the center of the room. It was on top of a huge golden pentagram, and they had a ceremony there.
Okay, now how many other children were with you being inducted into the family or the order, as they call it?
There were two other children at that point, but there were several adults too.
Okay.
See, the church also brings in adults to swear their allegiance too. Just so you know, I was told, and I don't know if this is true, but if you can arise to a certain position within the Catholic Church hierarchy, you do have to go through that ceremony as well.
Okay, so you're down in this room with your parents weren't present.
No. The German father and the French father were,
Okay, and at that point, tell our listeners what you witnessed.
Well, there was a table, it looked like dark glass in the center of the room. I mean, it was made out of stone, but it was very shiny and dark and black. And it may have been something like obsidian or onyx. I'm not sure. You know, I'd have to. That's the only time I've seen stone like that. And it had, like, around the corners, they had, like, these gold, I guess, channels that you know, to collect fluids. And little boy was in the center of the table on drugs. I think he was drugged because he was very quiet. He didn't move or say anything during the ceremony.
This was a little 3 or 4 year old boy.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
And then they continued to go ahead. They continued to do a child sacrifice.
Yes,
right
they
in front
did.
Of you.
Yes. Yeah, I told you about that before. Yeah.
Now afterwards, unbelievable experience for a youth. I mean, for a 12-year-old. I mean, what went through your mind? I guess when that happened. I mean,
I was terrified. I mean, I was absolutely horrified. I can't describe the terror you feel when you go through something like that.
And do you remember the words they were saying as this was going on?
The man was in scarlet. He was speaking in Latin. And basically he was saying, you know, please accept the sacrifice, you know, on this day. But then, you know, and then he said the sacrifice will seal the ceremony. And then he did it. Again, I was so terrified that have you ever been in a situation where your heart's racing, but you can't do anything, and so you're just kind of sitting there and you're kind of like fading in and out?
I can remember as a youth being frightened, but I don't think I've ever gone through anything quite like what you have.
Yeah, imagine your heart rate going up to about 220. You can't move, so you're kind of shaking, but trying like not to show it.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible. And I keep thinking inside, I can't wait. Oh, I can't wait. I mean, you don't say this, but inside you're just kind of saying over and over, I can't wait till it's over. I can't wait till it's over. I can't wait till it's over. Afterwards, the man in scarlet, he had a huge golden ring on his hand, and he came over to the center of the room, and he had each of the people that were swearing that day, I had to go forward and kneel before him and kiss his ring and swear my allegiance to the new order, to the new world order, until my death.
Now, and at that point, you are escorted out.
Yes. After the ceremony was all over. I mean, the other people also did theirs as well. You know, they had to swear their allegiance too.
They were the same age as you?
The two children were, but there were also three adults that went forward and did the same. And afterwards, we were told, may the same to you or worse occur should you ever break this oath.
So it's basically, imagine at that age, and you weren't really prepped for this, were you? I mean, you were told there was a ceremony, but nothing, you didn't expect anything like this, from what
to you. It was very difficult to go through, just because the sense of horrific oppression down there, too, was the worst. I mean, I've gone through some ceremonies in my life, and the Illuminati, you do go through them. But I have to say that in my experience, this was the worst, just because I can't explain the amount of darkness in a room like that, just the pure evil. And unless you've ever been seen oppression, I mean, it's just horrible. It wasn't just what happened, but just, I mean, the oppression. And I'm a Christian now, and I know the difference now between when there's evil present, oppression, or when God's love is present and joy and peace, which is the exact opposite of what was in that room.
Now, you know what I find quite interesting about this? About 25 years ago, I was a reporter and a freelance writer in Rome, and I spent 6 years there. I walked through the Vatican many, many times, hundreds of times, covered the papal addresses, things like that. And during that time, I was there during a Vatican scandal, which involved the church bank and other things, members of the Illuminati, the Freemasons. I was approached by a woman on Via Veneto. I'll never forget this. Rome's a small town, and people knew I was covering stories about the secret societies, things like that, because I had to ask people. Well, this woman came up to me and told me similar stories. She wasn't quite as specific because she couldn't handle it. She would break out crying.
Yeah.
And had tried to commit suicide twice because she couldn't get out of the Illuminati. She was a member, she was, again, born into it, a very wealthy Northern Italian family. And she told me basically the same ceremony took place with her. And so when I started talking to you, I wanted to relay that to you and to also relate to my listeners that I heard about this 25 years ago. From a woman by the name of Maria and many other people, several other people in Italy that I talked to. I was never able to locate or really, probably for my own safety, never find out what happened. But again, Svali's corroborating a story that I heard about 25 years ago. We'll get back after this break with this incredible story about a member of the Illuminati who's now out of the group and safe on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. We're talking to Svali, a member of the family, the Order, the Illuminati for over 30 years. Svali, you leave the induction ceremony, you walk out into the Vatican courtyard, and what do you leave with one of the fathers, I believe. What did he tell you then?
At that point, he just told me to never forget that, you know, he told me that I performed well during the ceremony because I didn't scream or, you know, pass out or anything like that. So he said, you do very well, and he was pleased. And then we went and stayed at a home nearby, a local, it must have been a local person. I didn't know them. We spent the night there before we went back to Germany.
Okay, and what about the other people during the ceremony? How did they handle themselves? Do you remember?
I'm going to say, unfortunately, I'm so... And when you're in that kind of situation, the last thing they're thinking about sometimes is what the other people are doing. I was just so trying to not, like, lose it myself. And that I do know that, I mean, no one screamed or shouted, you know, or anything like that. Everyone was quiet. I think to say dead silence is, unless the person was spoken to, is true. Or unless they had to go forward and kiss the ring.
Let's move on. I think we the question I wanted to ask you, and this is such a wide subject. I've had a chance to talk to you a number of days, and I've done some stories about it. You go back home. You're 12 years old. You said you were schooled into 12 disciplines. So your life begins, and you know now you're in some type of organization that isn't that is very different than what most people experience. But tell us, you know, I guess what I want to do is leave it open to you to begin. I mean, you've written so in-depth on this story. I'm just going to give you the microphone and let you begin and tell the listeners what you think is important about your original training, about the group, and about, you know, many things that I know people want to know about the Illuminati. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, Greg, first I want to say that my purpose in talking about this is not to glorify evil, because there are very wicked people out there, very powerful people. And I don't want to at all magnify their power, but I do want people to know that this is real, that these people exist, that people who say there are people out there that are involved in this activity, it really happened. I also, because I know that there are children being hurt in the group every day, and that's my motivation for coming forward. I don't like giving interviews for obvious reasons. But I'm willing this one time to lay aside my thoughts of personal safety because these people need to be stopped. It needs to be stopped.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, go ahead.
And normally children in the group are born into it. While the Illuminati very rarely does outside recruitment, that's not their main method. It's just passed down generationally from father to son and mother to daughters to children until the whole family line is in it. Throughout the centuries, people have tried to escape, but a lot of times they were either poisoned, murdered, or set up to look like a suicide. They don't like it when people leave, and they try to make it very difficult. Simply because it looks bad. they go through an enormous amount of training from the time you're an infant. You undergo indoctrination. And when I say indoctrination, I don't just mean like cult programming so much as watching your parents and seeing what they do. My parents modeled their behavior. To them, the group was very important. So growing up, I saw that 3 times a week, everything was dropped to attend to the activities. Okay?
Okay.
When a lot of, and after, through, basically the training process is designed to help you take on your adult role in the group. The Illuminati covers so many levels, though, too. It goes all the way from what most people think of as like a satanic coven type thing at the very low local level, all the way through. It's a huge, enormous business corporation. At the mid-levels, you have people overseeing finances and administration, who are overseeing, I mean, these people are making a lot of money through gun running, through white slavery, prostitution, pornography. They have links and ties to the mafia left and right. And, in fact, the mafia are afraid of them. Yeah. No, well, think about it. I mean, you know, but because they know that you don't cross the, you know, the members of the group. They have a very spiritual orientation. They're not satanic, though. They're Luciferian, which is a difference. But mm-hmm. their ultimate goal of their spiritual philosophy and their steps of discipline is they believe that should you complete all of your training, that you become a god. That is their actual end goal. They believe in the achievement of godhood, of luminous philosophy, through different means, through what they call enlightenment or illumination, which is how they got their name.
Mm-hmm.
They're international. In Europe, there's 12 fathers who sit that represent the different nations of Europe. They are very expectantly awaiting he who is to come. And during that ceremony in the Vatican, I on my knees, I had to swear my allegiance to serve he who is to come. They believe
so, can you... I have to take a break. We'll continue
sure.
with the massive organization. Your role as a mid-level person in the Illuminati on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal, and I'm talking with Svali. Svali, why don't we just pick it right up where we left off at the break? You were telling us about this hierarchy that it starts with 12 fathers. Can you just run that down for us so people know exactly how this group's organized?
Sure. At the top levels... It's in Rome. That's the center or the heart of the Illuminati. That's where the power base is. And that's why all leadership must wear fealty in Rome, because that's considered the core of the spiritual center of the universe is how they view it. From there, in Europe, there are 12 fathers, one for each country in Europe. When I was younger, too, I had to also meet with the fathers at one point. And kiss their rings and go to another ceremony of allegiance to them as well. There's in the Illuminati, the European fathers, though, rule over what are called the different houses. For instance, if you're from Germany, then you belong to the German house. If you're from France, you belong to the French house. They call them houses. UK, Russia, Poland, Belgium, Spain, Italy, and others. From there, America was considered a mission field for them. And in the 1600s, Pittsburgh became the first port of entry for them, and that's where they first settled. And so that's why it's still considered a spiritual power base for the group on the East Coast in the U.S.
You know, and I did want to mention one thing. A caller or a listener or a reader of your stories sent me an email, said, Greg, check into the reason why President Bush, right after being elected, went to Pittsburgh and talked to a Masonic group there. I found that quite interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's the spiritual power base for the group. From there, it spread out, of course, to the Atlantic seaboard and then throughout the nation. And while the nation is divided into many regions, multiple regions, 7 main regions, the East Coast region has its spiritual power base in Pittsburgh, but the administrative power base is in Alexandria, Virginia. That's where they administer the finances during the day-to-day operations. The West Coast, or the West region, or west of the Mississippi, has its power base in the San Diego area.
And that's where you spend a lot of time, correct?
Yes. I was sent from, the Alexandria Council sent me to San Diego to help them out.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's see. Those are the two, of course, main regions, and then each of those regions are divided into sub-regions. And so then you have your regional council sitting over those and overseeing the activities. I mean, if you can think of the structure of a large multinational corporation, that's really how the Illuminati is structured. Then beneath each of the regional councils are your local councils. They call them sister groups or sister, or your local councils, and then you have your local groups under those as well. Or what they call the sister groups. So any major metropolitan city could have anywhere from 5 to 15 groups, depending on the size population base.
Now, you were saying that how many people are in this group in America, about, from your estimate of knowing a lot of this stuff? Go ahead.
Pure Illuminati, I'd say about 1%, give or take.
It's a fairly big organization, correct?
Yes. Oh yeah.
Now they're, just their goal basically. Just give us the broad overview goal, and then I want to get into some of these, your role in it, and some of these ways that the Illuminati makes money that you learned about. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, when you say to rule the world, it almost sounds laughable. Like, yeah, right. You know, I think people get ideas of like thinking in the brain, wanting to rule the world, but really that is their goal. They believe that they are the intelligent leaders, and they believe that the rest of the world are sheep who need wise. They see themselves as wise leadership, so they believe that their goal is to rule the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but at the same time, they have ways of doing this. Their main methods of doing so are behind the scenes. They believe in infiltration of the media, of education, and of government. Those are the three areas, and of the financial system, and they've successfully done quite a bit of all four throughout Europe and the U.S. as well as other countries.
Now, you said that Illuminati is divided into about 6 or 7 different groups, and everyone is born into a group. Can you outline what those groups are?
Well, no, it's all one group, but it just has different levels, you know.
Yeah, that's what I mean, like the sciences, the government.
The Illuminati is divided into different branches of learning. And these branches include sciences, military, government, leadership, scholarship, and spiritual. Those are the six branches of learning. And while all children need to undergo some training or teaching in each area, as they get older, they begin profiling you from infancy, and they know where your aptitudes and abilities are. Then most people specialize in one branch or possibly two branches of learning.
And you were involved in what branch?
I was heavily involved in sciences, and also to some degree, I did some spiritual as well, but mainly sciences.
Just to backtrack 1 minute, these 12 disciplines, as a child, you were rigorously trained in this, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And what were those disciplines? I mean, you don't have to go through each one of them, but what primarily were you taught?
I think the best way would be to just give you an example of just one type of training that they do.
Okay.
When I was 2 years old, I was left in a room for probably a 24-hour period. When you're that age, it's hard to estimate, but it was a long time. I know that the sun did go around at least once. You know, it wasn't just like a few hours. And at that age, when you're 2 and you're left completely alone without food and water, you're terrified. And at the end of the time, I was just dying of thirst. I remember I've never been so thirsty in my entire life. And my mother walked into the room, because a lot of times they have the children, you know, or the parents as train the children at these early ages. And there was a table in the middle of the room, and I'm sitting at it. And she sits at it, and she brings in this cold pitcher of water, and she starts pouring it. I said, "Mom, I want a drink of water." And she slapped me out of the chair. And I remember crying, and I'm like, and as I'm crying, and she's drinking the water in front of me. Then she leaves. She takes a pitcher of water, and a couple of hours later, she came back in and did the same thing. I said, Mama, Mama, I want water. And she slapped me, I mean, across the room. And after this had happened about three times, luckily I was bright enough that by the third time she came in, I mean, I remember crying silently. I just looked at her. I didn't ask. And after she got up and left with the pitcher, then a man came into the room. He said, you did very well that time. And then he gave me a drink of water. And I've always, you know, that was part of the learning not to want stage. And looking back on it, I realize now as an adult that the purpose of that training was to teach me not to recognize my own physiological needs and respond to them, but to look to outside people to tell me what I wanted or needed.
You told me that you led kind of a dual life in the Illuminati. I mean, that's basically how they function. They have
a
day job, and then at nighttime you're quite busy sometimes with the cult's activities, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What I wanted to get into, you were talking about these groups. I remember I mentioned to you, you said you had meetings three times a week, and I said, well, what about if I wanted to go and visit? Maybe do a story about them. What would happen, or how would I be able to find one of these meetings that were going on where in your area of Escondido?
Well, no, because of the security measures. And A, you really don't want to show up unannounced at a meeting if you could get through their security, because chances are you would never make it out alive. Let's just say that a sudden auto accident would occur and be reported in the papers. Unfortunate accident, man accidentally runs into tree. I mean, I'm serious. But the security that they have during group meetings is so intense that it would be very difficult. They have security at the 1 mile perimeter, the 3 mile perimeter, and the 5 mile perimeter. They have three people assigned, usually one like up in a tree where you can't see them at the 5 mile perimeter, and then you have one person who's standing who looks like a security guard for the state, because these are often large wealthy states, which is appropriate, and he's dressed in the uniform. And the third person standing hidden behind a tree. As cars come through and they come through the gates, because remember these are gated estates.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not someone on their approved license checklist, they'll stop the car and they say, it's just like at a military installation. They'll say, can I help you? Are you lost? Their goal is to delay the person. Now, if a person's saying, is this blah, 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 and they're just asking directions, they'll give them directions, they'll be very pleasant and send them on their way to where they're supposed to be going. But if they are acting as if they want to go further into the state, and this is not an okay person, then the person, they will say, you say he's not expecting you. That's a code word. That tells a person either behind, up in the tree, hidden, or else hidden further back. They radio ahead and they say, unexpected visitor. At that point, everyone has been trained to pick up and leave immediately within 5 minutes. No traces of the activity.
So this is some of the methods they go through so you don't get caught. I know that you wrote an article about why the cult doesn't get caught, and that's pretty specific. I mean, you have so much stuff here, and we can't get into it all in 2 hours, so please pick and choose what you think is most important. But I found that to be interesting, why the cult doesn't get caught. Is there anything in just a brief time you could explain to us that?
Well, their security, their money, their influence. Some of these people even own newspapers. Imagine trying to get an article published, disclosing. There's a lot of reasons why they don't get caught, because that's the first thing people ask. But then my next question is, how many top pornographers are out there that the police have been chasing for years and have never found or caught?
Correct.
And they're not even members of a secret organization. They're just trying to hide, you know? So
You are a mid-level person in this organization, a head trainer. We're going to get into those specifics in the next hour. But, you know, what did you learn about the infiltration of this group into all of our different areas of government, media? They're basically at the high levels of most of our financial institutions also, correct?
Yeah.
And that is a great way to pursue their goal. And I guess I got to ask you this. Why? How come things are moving a little bit faster in America now? I remember back in the 80s when I was confronted with this, when I came back home, I didn't really see this kind of New World Order movement, all this different symbolism that you see now. What is going on, just for our listeners, right now? Why are things stepped up since 9/11?
I believe it's because they can see the fulfillment of their goal. I'm going to sound very cynical now, and okay, please forgive me for this, but see, their goal is to rule the world, and personally, I believe that they do. It's just not open yet. Mm-hmm. And they see now preparing people for when they disclose it themselves openly. Does that mean that they can't be stopped? I believe they could. I believe they'd take a miracle because of the amount of infiltration I've seen at all levels of society and the world. These people and women have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence. And your average person has no idea of how much that is going on behind the scenes that no one understands. But with that said, so basically, I mean, I think that they're already there. They just aren't open. These people just don't know where they're going. If they did, I think the average person would be horrified to know how much is going on behind the scenes that people really don't know.
Yeah, and the point of this interview, one, I had two goals in this interview.
But I don't want to sound despairing because I'm also a strong Christian. I have faith in God, and I believe that through prayer and through people knowing that, I mean, I would like them to be stopped. I just don't know at this point, how do you take on the financial institutions of the world, the major oil enterprises of the world, you know? That's the question.
Yeah, you know, it's a difficult question. Now, you're in the mid-level of this group. You worked your way up to a head trainer, correct?
Yeah.
Now, what did you learn? Before we get into the specifics, you outline in some of your writings the big money-making, the ways this group makes its money. Can you go over and outline some of those methods?
Again, if you can think of an illegal activity, they're probably involved at some point. Maybe not overtly at the point of where the actual money is first changing hands. But when you have child pornography, prostitution, white slavery, gun running, gambling, then at some point where the money is changing hands, buffered by about four layers of people, there's going to be probably someone from the Illuminati involved at that point. These guys have their fingers in everything.
Now, go ahead.
But they also use legitimate means. They launder the money. I mean, when you have a lot of money, you have to do something with it. And so what they'll call it, these men don't come in and say, "Hi, I'm a member of the Illuminati, and I want to, like, run your bank." But what they'll do is they'll quietly come in and become a quiet investor, start buying up shares. And over a period of maybe almost a lifetime, they will get a controlling interest in the bank. Or else become a very, you know, and maybe in their son's lifetime, because that's the other thing about Illuminati. The Illuminati do not see it as it must happen now in my lifetime. These people have goals that last for a century or two centuries. They're very, very patient.
And that's why the specific training of the children is so important, correct?
Yes. Yes. It's to teach you patience. Everyone mm-hmm. knows growing up in the group, they know that we may not see the coming order disclosed or open or revealed in that lifetime, but our children or our grandchildren may. So they will spend their entire life trying to bring about the goals of the organization.
Incredible. So now you're in the mid-level, and I can see now where they use the programming techniques, the different mind control techniques.
Yeah.
We had a minute before the break, just kind of what our interest about how you, what your specific role was.
Well, they did a lot of what you might call human experimentation, and they had a lot of research protocols going on. So one thing I did was to supervise the research going on. I was teaching the younger trainers and head trainers how to do things more efficiently, how to do their job well, but also reviewing their research reports for errors or problems. Eventually, I became kind of a consultant. If a problem occurred, or if they didn't know how to install something, or if they needed assistance, I would help them with problem solving as well.
Okay, Zvali, I'm going to attempt to take a break. We'll be back in 3 minutes. We'll continue on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I got a short 4 minute segment here, then we'll take a break and come back with Zvali for a whole nother hour. We're talking about some of the jobs in the Illuminati, the practical daily jobs that these members of this group who are infiltrated in America heavily take what they do. Now, one thing I find interesting, Zvali, is, you know, in the media, you know, I'm not going to name names or anything else. I don't have any specific information, but I find it interesting doing some background checks, and a lot of the top media people in our country, they all come from these very wealthy families. And, you know, that's not the typical MO for a journalist. A journalist is somebody, you know, grows up on the street, wants to talk to people. I mean, I can think of Jimmy Breslin, guys who never went to college, didn't know how to type, and just got in there and took their tie off and started writing stories. But, you know, as you look at the media now, these are all these silver spoon kids growing up with silver spoons. I find that quite interesting. How deeply infiltrated, from your knowledge, are they in our media?
Well, pretty. I mean, I do know fairly deeply. I remember that when I was in San Diego on leadership council during meetings, they would laugh about how people had no idea of how much they were being influenced and didn't even know it. They found that kind of amusing, which is, I mean, that's the mindset of people in the group, though. They're like, the sheep has no idea that they're being led by the man. And they find it amusing because they show it as evidence of this. I'm sorry. I mean, I'm just describing what they say. I don't agree with it now, but they saw it as evidence of the stupidity of the average person, that they have no idea. I'm not saying that every news story or every newscaster is a member of the group, by no means. But they specifically do teach and train and educate children to show an aptitude for the media, because they want that. And if a person has a bright, charismatic personality and presents well, then that's just that child will go into that if they have the verbal communication and other skills required.
Correct. And, you know, that could explain why a lot of our stories really never get covered outside of the influence they have financially and the ownership of the media.
Absolutely not by coincidence.
What's
not
that?
Not at all a coincidence.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a good idea why, folks, you're not getting the news from those outlets. I mean, we have, not only in our government, it explains, you know, a lot of things. I mean, why, look at the war in Iraq. Look at the evidence there that shows that it was wrong. Look at what they're doing in Iran right now. I mean, it's incredible. All this stuff, it's pretty obvious, people. You know, there's something behind it. Zvali is here trying to explain this organization from her knowledge, and it's quite a story. I know this idea, you were involved as a trainer, mind programming. I mean, this is just, I'm looking at some of the chapters in a book you have yet to publish. I mean, we're talking about brainwave, color control, metal, jewel programming linked to stories, movies. I mean, it goes suicidal program. And just a minute here before I break, can you kind of break down what you learned about the importance? Well, oh, we got to take a break, Zvali. Sorry. We're going to do that quickly. Then we'll get back to you. We're talking to Zvali regarding her role as a head trainer in the Illuminati and the American Illuminati. We'll be back on the Republic Broadcasting Network in 2 minutes. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. One more hour, we're talking to Zvali, and she was a head trainer in the Illuminati. Zvali, what type of programming do they actually teach you, and how do you learn these different techniques?
Well, you're taught from childhood on. My training in how to be a programmer was very young. I was mentored by another programmer at the age of five by a doctor at George Washington University. And he not only did he do the programming on me, but also taught me how to do it to others. The types of programming, again, that could be a whole 10-hour segment to go into depth. Just briefly, from the time a child's an infant, all through their life, basically, they're tested, they're profiled. The trainers can create a psychological profile, and then they update it frequently. And basically, they're trying to install in the child the ability to obey, loyalty to the group, and the ability to do their job within the group. Now, those jobs vary in complexity. I mean, you may have, on one side, a child trained to be a prostitute. On the other end, you may have someone, a child trained to become a governmental figure, which is a lot more complex programming. But as long as the loyalty to the group is instilled first, and that's the first and foremost programming always installed, then no matter what their eventual role is, they will remain loyal, and that becomes their first loyalty. Whatever nation, whatever their public role in life is, their first and foremost loyalty will be to the group and to serve its goals. Whether they know, a lot of times the goal there too is to be able to help the child create that complete division between their day role and their night role. So a pleasant, charming, wonderful, kind person in the daytime could be an absolutely cold, ruthless person at night. Or during the day, you know, it's also during the day they do it. They may, you may have a housewife with children who goes out and completes a courier job for the group. And no one would ever suspect her. This frumpy-looking old housewife with a baby in a car seat is actually carrying some valuable documents. Or, again, I mean, the first and foremost, though, is they want to instill loyalty. And they want to discourage people from questioning orders. They really don't want you questioning that, and they want you to obey their directives. And should people show signs of not doing that, then they go in for tips. Actually, people are being programmed all through their life. We used to call them tune-ups, you know, and it's a lifelong process for members of the group.
So, you know, we have a minute here before our break, and then we'll get back and get in depth in some of these areas. But what went wrong with you? I mean, the dropout rate probably is very low, considering the number of, considering the training. But what went wrong with you? They somehow missed something.
When I was very young, I absolutely believed in the goals of it. You never saw a more loyal group member. I thought that they were saving the world. I thought that they were doing a wonderful thing. But the older I got, I started to see the methods that were being used were so wrong and that the end did not justify the means. I became increasingly cynical, partly because I saw what I was doing to people. I was lying to them. I was manipulating them. I was telling them things that weren't true. And I remember questioning this, thinking, I was told lies as a child too then. I was manipulated. And finally, wow. You know, things like that, you start to question as an adult.
Okay. All right, we're gonna take a break. So we'll be back in 3 minutes on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Okay, we're back on the Investigative Journal. Svali, I wanted to ask you a question before we get into how you finally left the group and what happened to you afterwards, your life now. Tell us, you wrote an article. It was kind of interesting, A Day in the Life of a Trainer for the Illuminati. Tell us kind of what you went through in a normal day. In your role at the Illuminati. Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, I would get up. At the time that I described in that article, I was teaching at a Christian school. And so I would get up. I would get my two children. I dressed ready for school. Look just like a normal mom, you know. Go through the day, come home. You know, we'd have little friends over and play and stuff like that. And then have dinner. You know, I was a good mom. I was your average American housewife. I mean, on the surface.
Okay.
But underneath the surface, then my husband and I would remind each other on nights when there was a meeting. And then what we would do is when we go to sleep, I had programming in place that would allow me to wake up within 10 minutes of a specified time. So if I knew there was a meeting that night, I would wake up 10 minutes before it was time to, you know, get ready and go. A lot of times we would even go to bed with our clothes on. And I never thought that was that normal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I thought everyone went to bed with their clothes on. Didn't even question it, you know, on nights when we had meetings. I thought, oh, it's warmer.
Okay.
And then we'd get up and go and drive to the meeting. And I was also very involved in military in San Diego. In fact, the group has a lot of military orientation, and so a lot of times I would take the kids to their area. There's the area where the kids would go and change. They had a room, and we would have, like, baskets of clothes, and we'd change our clothing. You'd take out your clothing, you know, it had your name on it, and put on your uniform or whatever you wore that night. And the kids would wear these little miniature military uniforms. And then they would go out and do their training exercises. They were learning how to march, how to shoot. All kids in Illuminati know, at least in that area, know how to, like, take apart a gun, put it together, and shoot with deadly accuracy by the age of 8 years old. Martial arts, there's a lot of martial arts training. Sometimes that helps supervise that, or fill in if a military trainer was, because, you know, you had to know how to do it. Everyone had to be, there's a lot of cross training. But most of the time I supervised the training. I would be working on implementing programming or what we call tuning up, you know, reinforcing previously installed programming in adults. At that point, I was normally supervising the younger trainers. They would be doing it, and I would be there watching and making sure they did it correctly. I would be also evaluating, like, whether sometimes every once in a while we'd be working on something that was somewhat experimental, and then I would be taking a more active role, assessing the person's responses to the new protocol, recording it, and if there was any difference between established parameters for that protocol or expected responses, you know, I'd be flagging that.
Give me an example of someone that you were working on. How would they be introduced? What would be the reason? Are they in the military? How does someone get sent to you?
No, these were all members of the group.
Oh, okay.
In fact, I can tell you that in San Diego, 20% of the active members of the group were active military.
Okay.
Okay, and think military intelligence. Think high-ranking officials, colonels, commanders. My ex-husband was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, getting ready to become a commander, okay?
All right.
These are not stupid people.
So you're basically involved in working on the programming of the members involved, too.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No. We didn't program people that weren't members of the group. You cannot install significantly traumatic mind control programming in a person who is not a member of the group. Now, there are what you can do is what we call passive programming, which is basically through media means. You know, you can set, if someone's watching a television program, they go immediately into alpha state. Everyone in the group, I mean, even the baby in the group knows that because these people are very much into behavioral psychology. And that's a trance state almost, a very relaxed state where messages can be implemented. And that's why I very strongly suggest people be very careful about the TV shows they watch. That's all I'll say about that. But no, you cannot take an adult who's not a member of the group and do what we did to them. They would go psychotic or they wouldn't survive it, probably. They wouldn't be able to psychologically handle it.
Tell us some examples of what you were doing, program techniques.
Sometimes it would involve, normally it would start with a hypnotic induction. Or even sometimes we'd inject a medication. A lot of times, especially young children, have a lot of fear when they're going into programming, but adults did too. We want them to relax. We'd give them a very short-acting medication to relax them. We would then invoke a hypnotic state in them. We would then, if it's an older person, I'd be checking the codes already installed. If I was getting ready to install programming in a young child, I would explain to them very patiently exactly the behavior expected. I'd say, I want you to do this and this and this. I'd break it up into steps, and I'd say, first we're going to practice this. I would show the child what I want them to do. I'd model it. I would then tell the child, do it. The child would then do it. Okay. But normally they won't do it well the first time, so she or he would get shocked. That was called, because the group very much uses what they call positive and negative reinforcement. Okay, if a child did not do it perfectly the first time, they're shocked. That's the negative reinforcement. Then I'd say, do it again. They would show me the behavior. Now, at this point, we start associating the behavior with an external stimulus or cue, too. Now, a lot of times the child is, if this is a behavior, though, that we want associated with a specific code, the child will often have been traumatized very heavily first to create a fragmentation in their personality. And then the behavior and the associated cue are given. Like, you might hear a tone like, bing, bing, bing. All right, I want you to do this, bing, bing, bing. The child hears the tone, they get up, and they do the behavior. Once they can perform it perfectly, they're rewarded with praise, good job, or a hug. Children like hugs or something like that. Then you do it over and over and over. That's why trainers have to be very patient people. Because then maybe after the child's done it 50 times, when they hear the cue, they get up, they do it. It's not even a conscious, it's reflexive. At that point, it's considered installed. For very, very important programming, I'm talking about like end-level assassin programming, because we did train people how to assassinate people, and that's a whole other topic that I don't want to go into here. We would then do a ritual to seal the programming. Afterward.
Okay. You know something, I was just looking at some of your articles. One was Christmas in the Cult, just to get off on a different subject here.
Sure.
And you say this is quite different for you when you were growing up than it is for most children. Can you just kind of briefly tell us what you meant by that?
Yeah, I mean, we had trees and presents and things like that, but for most children, Christmas is just happy time, you know, lots of presents. But in the group, very high ceremonies that are celebrated. Many times I flew to Germany, and there was no Santa Claus. They had a figure called Father Yule, who is mm-hmm. who represents Christmas there, but he is not the kind of benevolent Santa that you see here. This is a man with a golden scepter dressed in a white robe and a golden sash around, and I was once at the German father's house where there was a gathering of children and adults, and Father Yule was present, and he raises the scepter and basically strikes down the child in front of everyone.
Oh, my God.
I know. Yes, he struck down the child with his scepter, and that is not what you call a happy Christmas, you know.
No.
Now, at the same time, yes, we did have tree and fruitcake and all that and decorate the house, but there's another side to Christmas.
I'm just listening and I just can't believe, we got leaders in our country that have probably gone through this kind of stuff. I mean, it's just incredible, this group. I mean, I know they've been around for a long, long time, thousands of years, and gone through, came here, George Washington was a 33rd degree Mason, and we go on. I want you to understand what, just from my point of view, I just wonder how, you write a story, The End of the Illumina, how do we get rid of these people? I know you're out of it. You couldn't take it anymore, but do you think we can inspire more mid-level people to just leave like you so they have no one to do this kind of insidious, crazy programming and lifestyle? What do you think?
Well, I believe that as strongly as a Christian, that it's a spiritual warfare as well as a emotional and psychological warfare. I believe that by the grace of God, but I will also say that when I was in the group, a lot of the members are not happy. You will have people in the group that are there because they love it, because they believe in the goals, they're totally dedicated. But to be honest, I knew as many people who would have left in a minute if they thought that they could get out and make it.
To break in and then go back to that, do they marry you to somebody in the group, or is that forced on you?
No, in the group, the marriages are always arranged in my experience. In my 38 years in the group, I never knew of a couple in the Illuminati that did not have an arranged marriage. It's
Let me just mention a couple that I suspect. Clinton and Bill and Hillary.
Oh, well, yeah. Yes, definitely.
Yes,
and
Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah. And a lot of times these marriages are arranged for compatibility, but also for bloodlines, to bring the right bloodlines together.
Okay, good. We're going to be back in 3 minutes. I want to continue this, and then we're going to get into Zvali's life after the Illuminati on the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Okay, well, we're back on the Investigative Journal. I'm your host, Greg Szymanski. And let me tell you, as an interviewer, someone who has researched the Illuminati for a long time, it started way back when I was a young reporter in Rome. It's a whole different ballgame when you're actually talking to someone with experiences like this. It takes it out of that realm of what is quasi-fiction fact into the realm of reality, and it's really shocking. And I'll be honest with you, this is a story that, folks, you have to listen to, because this is going on in our country. All the things you're seeing regarding our rights being taken away, the police state, the war in Iraq, 9/11, all these things have to do with this powerful group. And Zvali, you know, we're talking about mid-level people, then we're going to talk about some of the lower-level people. I'm interested who they are. But I imagine a lot of these, you said they weren't happy, but a lot of them probably stay because it's very, I mean, it's a very, very lucrative way to live, I imagine. You're from wealthy families.
Oh, yeah. In fact, and that's the main thing that's one of the factors that keeps people in. The reason more people don't leave is because leaving means giving up your husband, your children, your entire family on both sides, your money. And basically, for a lot of people leaving the group, it means giving up everything and starting out penniless and alone. And not only that, but then you're combating internal programming to recontact, to go back, to be loyal, to be a good member.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known many people that tried to leave and then went back because they just couldn't take it.
Do you want to take a phone call right now to break it up?
Sure.
Okay, Marilyn in California. You're on the Investigative Journal, Marilyn.
Yes, I've been just sort of caught part of this. I lost part of it. I'm listening on the Internet, but I didn't quite catch it. How did this woman become involved in this Illuminati training?
Go ahead. Can you explain that, Zvali?
Yeah, I was taught it from early childhood. I was mentored into it. Trainers in the group are mentored. You work with older adults, and they show you, and you are given increasing responsibility. Until by the time you're in your teens, you are basically doing adult training responsibilities. You've been taught for years.
Parents put you in it, or?
Yes, they were members.
Oh, I see. So it comes down through the parent, one parent to another.
Are or from both.
Are they private schools?
You what?
Are these private school?
Well, when my children were schooled at private Christian schools, they were all Illuminati.
Oh, okay. You're saying that the Christian schools are Illuminati?
Some of them are. Not all, but some. The ones that my children were in were specifically. But, no, there's a lot of good Christian schools that have nothing to do with the group, but some can be. Now, I went to a public school, but what's interesting is out of three public schools I went to as a young child, two have burned down. So there's no access to any school records.
I'll be darned.
Marilyn, just to get you up to speed, you're born into this, then you're trained as a young child, you go through an induction ceremony in the Vatican, and this is going on with 1-2% of our population, according to Zvali, very serious in all levels, government and everything else. Go ahead, Marilyn, you have another question?
Yeah, when you say the Vatican, now that is not a Christian religion, okay? So, I mean, I'm a Christian. But we do not look at Catholics as a Christian religion. We look at them as the precursor of the New World religion. So,
if I may just break in, I grew up a Catholic. I don't get involved in the splicing of the religions. I'm basically stating that when I started researching the Illuminati as a reporter in Rome, and I realized there was a bad portion of the church, I looked at it. I had to deal with the evil and the good. And so that's the way I reconciled it, the evil within the Catholic Church at the high level of the Vatican, which seeps down into many, many areas. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I won't argue that point. I don't agree with it. But it sounds like you have become possibly born again to get out of this. Could I be correct in that?
Yes, Marilyn, very much. Now, first, I do want to say I am not slamming the Catholic Church or the average Catholic. I have many good friends that are Catholics. They are strong Christians. I became a Christian, and that's the only way I could get out. But just so you know, though, too, a lot of card-carrying Illuminists, well, we don't really carry cards, but I'm using that term.
Yes.
Are members of the Baptist Church, are members of Pentecostal churches. In fact, I was on a worship team for a Wesleyan church in San Diego in my day life. A Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just very, very confused. I mean, I think this is interesting, and as far, you know, many people say that the Catholic Church will be the forerunner of the new world religion. There's some very good books out. In fact, I think you may have interviewed one of these men, the Grand Plan Design, the John Daniel.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember that?
Sure.
But the average Catholic has no idea of what's going on in the Vatican.
Yeah. I think that's interesting that the average Catholic would not know what's going on. That's just my take on it.
Well, I'll tell you something. As an average Catholic going to Rome my first time in 1980, I didn't know what was going on, and I grew up as a Catholic, went to Notre Dame High School. It was quite a learning experience for me.
Why do Catholics, when they find out how evil the Church is, stay in it? I mean, do they really? Why would they want to stay in it? That's what bothers me. I know some good people that are like that, and I don't get it.
Well, that's the only answer. I don't know. I mean, there are many Catholics that aren't actively practicing.
Yeah. Thank you.
But anyway, we'll leave that for another time. Thanks a lot, Marilyn. We'll be back on the Investigative Journal in 3 minutes with Zvali. Okay, you know, they're not going to get me, that's for sure. My house is anti-illuminated. It's not going to happen, folks. And, you know, just to end that, Svali, before I get back to you, just to end that conversation we had with Marilyn about Catholicism, I look back and I really thank my dad. And I do it in kind of a way, I'm just thinking about it now. I didn't know what the Church was about, but, you know, something strange did happen when I was young. My mom died, and I was 10 years old. My brother was 6 months old at the time. She died of leukemia. It was a very, very tragic affair. It left my dad and me and my brother alone. And I remember my dad literally took a priest, a head Monsignor in our parish, and it was, I won't even tell you where, St. John Brebeuf, right outside of Chicago. And this man came into our house, I'll never forget it, and said that he was going to put me and my little brother in an orphanage. And my dad literally picked him up and threw him out the door, literally. And from that point on, my dad never went back to church again. My brother never went to a Catholic school. I, of course, asked if I could finish only because I had friends there. But, you know, who knows what would have happened, looking back on what's the craziness that goes on in the Church. But anyways, while you were talking about... you know something, these people that are too, that do not want to get out because of the financial ties. But let's go back when you were in the Illuminati, and how did this happen? How did you finally leave? And tell us this whole story about you leaving the Illuminati. We haven't touched on that yet.
Sure. Well, I do want to say one thing that I agreed with Marilyn on. Without faith in God, I couldn't have done it, because I became a Christian. And that was for me revolutionary, because it made me question again more of what I was being taught or had believed all my life. I began to realize that what I was doing was wrong. I became increasingly cynical. And I also then started standing up to the head trainer in the county who despised me, because he would do things that were just blatantly cruel for no reason whatsoever. I'd say, "You're wrong." Well, people don't like that. And he took it out on me in a lot of horrible ways. But I finally made the decision to run. I ran to another state because I knew that my chances of getting out while still staying in that area with people I knew, surrounded by people who were in the group, was not going to be very good. So I went to another state.
You had to leave your family and everything, right?
Everything. Well, my children were with their grandparents, and at that point, I thought that was better than them being with my husband, and I was going to go get my kids. But my husband then called, and he said, "I want to reunite with you." And I said, "Okay, that's wonderful." And I said, "But you have to get help. You have to get some treatment, because we can't go on. You've got to get out of the group." And he said, "Okay." He said, "I'll pick up the kids and meet you in a week." So, you know, the day before he called, said, "I'll be there tomorrow, blah, blah, blah." And so I was excited, thinking, "Oh, he's getting out. That's wonderful." Instead, he had gotten the kids several days before. He was lying to me. I didn't know it. I had gone to a judge, and the day that he was supposed to arrive, there was a knock on my door. It was the policeman serving me a divorce papers and also a restraining order saying that I could not come within 100 yards of my husband or my children. And at that point, I felt slightly punished for leaving the group. I fought that, and I fought for 4 years with a court system that said that things like this didn't occur, because my husband would go into court and say, this woman's psychotic, she's making it all up, there's no way, ha, 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 this stuff doesn't happen this day and age, and the judge would say, you're right, slam, full custody to the father, and I had to have supervised visitation for 4 years with my own children, so that, because I was considered a kidnap risk. But through a lot of prayer, I had my whole church praying for me here in Texas, and through what I believe are a series of miracles, my children were finally allowed unsupervised visitation with me after 4 years. And during that time, I said to my daughter, who was 14, I said, I want so badly for you to get out. And she looks at me and she starts to go, oh, you shouldn't have said that, Mom. You shouldn't have said that, Mom. And she just freaked out. She just totally lost it. And I realized it was her programming cycling, because she was just terrified. You know, she was like, why did you say that? Why did you say that? You know, and I said, it's okay, honey, calm down, calm down. And then finally, she was just shaking and shaking. And then finally she said, well, I don't want to go back and get hurt. And then I said, you don't have to. And at that point, I faced federal prison, but I called my ex, and I said, I will not let those children go back and get hurt again. And he flew out to get them. And he could have put me in prison at the time, because I was breaking the custody visitation, and you know how strong the courts are on that?
Mm-hmm.
And I said to him, I said, please, you're... Look at, because my daughter and son said, we don't want to go back, Dad. We don't want to get hurt. We don't want to do this anymore. And he looked at them and he said, I want to go think about it. And so he went home. And I was praying for him at the time. And then that night he called me and he says, oh my God, oh my God. And I said, wait, he said, we've got to get out. And I'm like, yes, you do. And he made the decision to get out. At that point, he went to a notary public. He gave me, and he did a legal document, gave me full custody of my children. And then he said he was so sorry for it. He put me through the HLL. He put me through for years.
Now, have you had any reprisals from anybody in the group since you're leaving, or any warnings to be quiet or anything like that?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and there's one time when, I did write one article that named some specific dates and times, and I got hurt afterwards, and it made me very cautious. And that's why I don't give a lot of radio interviews, and why I don't do a lot of this.